Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you two from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for this hour, it's going to be the views of Colonel Barry Turner, who's retired from the British military. He was an engineer there for many years, and we're going to be talking about, of course, what's happening in Great Britain and, of course, in Europe. And, of course, what people really don't understand in America is what is happening in America today happened in Europe a long time ago. And, of course, without letting the people of either the continent or Great Britain know, a group of very wealthy and powerful men set out to destroy the sovereignty of the individual nations, to begin to mold them into this European Union, which is a forerunner, of course, to creating this one world government. And certainly if you go to Europe today, you'll see there the posters. They can show the picture of the unfinished Tower of Babel. It was a picture that was painted in the 1500s or 1600s. And, of course, it talks about speaking with one tongue, one voice. And that was, of course, the symbol of what happened under Nimrod when they tried to unite the world. However, if you go to Strasbourg today, you will see a building designed after that unfinished Tower of Babel. In other words, the building is completed, but it's built as an unfinished Tower of Babel, and that is where the European Parliament meets. And it should be very symbolic, obvious to anybody, that what we're seeing being played out today is this plan to create this one world government. And first of all, the European is simply one of the stepping stones towards that. And of course, what is happening at the present time is that the people of Europe are losing their freedom. The people of England are using their freedom. And with that as a background, Colonel, thank you so very much for being with us again.
It's nice to be back again so soon. Could I say good afternoon? I think last time I said good evening because it's midnight here. I think it's late afternoon your side.
Well, some people in the East Coast, it's pretty well getting a little late there at 7 o'clock as well.
Yes.
So it doesn't really matter. Hey, let's get your impression of what's going on and the things you'd like to bring to our listeners here in America and, of course, those who are listening across the world.
Well, I think one brief comment. Of course, you mentioned Strasbourg. My reaction is a sort of bloated bureaucracy, unelected, of course, which is imposing their diktat, of course, on this country. Unfortunately, over this side, it's being rubber-stamped to a large extent, rather than questioned or rejected. That is one of the problems. But I've been looking, going back over what we talked about last time. I think inevitably there has to be a certain repetition, which is no bad thing. But the term that's springing to mind at the moment, having made my notes and looked through a few papers, is the word conspiracy. Now, conspiracy theory, of course, is a term used to rubbish anybody who starts saying anything close to the truth. It's a trigger term, stops people thinking rationally. A lot of these terms used, like Islamofascism, extreme left, neo-fascist, neo-Nazi, and so on and so forth, hard right, which deter people from thinking any further. As far as this is concerned, a term which also springs to mind when people question conspiracy in the context of what we've been talking about and what we can talk about this evening, or this afternoon, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, if it looks like a duck, then it is a duck.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Arthur Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Colonel Barry Turner. He's with us from Great Britain. He's retired a British military, and we're talking about what's going on in England, in Europe, as there is an organized effort to take away the freedom from the people, to destroy the sovereignty of the individual nations, and without the consent of the people, without even their real knowledge, step by step, little by little, like a thief at night, they are simply centralizing all power in Strasbourg and certainly with the European Union. And we have edicts coming down, directives coming down, that certainly the members of the European Parliament, even the members of the European Parliament, have nothing to say about. There is a massive bureaucracy, unelected, that is taking everything under centralized planning, just like they have in Russia, like they have in communist China. Everything is being controlled by this massive bureaucracy, answerable to no man or woman. And, of course, eroding freedom step by step. And, of course, as Colonel Turner was saying, if you use the word conspiracy to explain this, why immediately you're vilified. And they have all these trigger words. They've come up with a new one. It's called Islamofascist. Who made it up? They made it up because it gets an emotion from you. And, of course, hard right, extremist. And when did you ever hear anybody talk about the hard left or the radical left? We don't talk about them. It's always the hard right. But you pick up the story there, Colonel.
Well, I think you made a very valid point there, of course. In the present climate, one rarely hears the left wing highlighted in a critical sense. You're absolutely right. I mean, one doesn't read the constant repetitive use of terms like hard right, extreme, hard left, extreme left, and so on. It's always the right, and there has to be a reason for that. I think at the center stage in my mind, apart from this conspiracy and what it's all about, which I find extremely worrying because it's very difficult to put an end point on it. I did mention this book by Tom Hartman, published in America in 2006, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. In other words, it reflects, in the context of the United States, what is happening over here, which is very interesting. Obviously, it's a much bigger scenario over your side. Here, I find it easier to pick over the bones of this.
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Turner was talking about a book published here in the United States called Screwed. And, of course, it's referring to what's happening, certainly in England, as they are moving to destroy the middle class. Now, they haven't destroyed the middle class here in America, but they plan it. But certainly this is being carried out over in Great Britain. You have your fabulously wealthy, and then, of course, for many years you've had a middle class, but they are under tremendous pressure today as their jobs are being eroded, the value of their currency is being destroyed, and, of course, their jobs are, of course, being replaced by immigrants or outsourced as the manufacturing and the jobs of Great Britain are being moved elsewhere, and, of course, we're beginning to see it here. But in Great Britain, the middle class is beginning to disappear. Would that be a fair statement?
Could you say that again? The middle class
is beginning to be coming under tremendous pressure.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
You go right ahead then.
It's becoming something of a trigger term because one never hears the upper classes or the rich classes highlighted. And they really should logically be far more vulnerable to criticism. Before we go on, perhaps I could read you a couple of extracts from the newsletter used to be published by the late Hilaire de Berrier. I always thought it was an excellent newsletter, and the H2B report, I think it was called. Now, the July-August 89 edition carried two interesting points. One, just because I happened to have seen it, looking for the main point. But this point is Walter Rathenau in 1912 stated, he was the Austrian Chancellor, He said 300 men who know each other and constantly select those who will succeed them direct the economic destinies of the world. Now, it's an interesting one to bear in mind, but what I was really after was a quote on a speech by Nicholas Murray Butler, a Fabian socialist. I'll read you what is here. Nicholas Murray Butler of the Fabian Society explained at a London banquet on November the 19th, 1937. Communism is the instrument with which the financial world can topple national governments and then erect a world government with a world police and a world money. Now, we seem to have gone pretty well down that path. The third point is that when we look at this evolving socialist world, the second S in USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, stood for exactly that, socialist, not communist. In the popular understanding of the Soviet Union under Stalin, it would logically have been USCR, but it's not. So we have this very clear link. And the other point is, with direct relevance to the middle classes, I came across in the British Guardian newspaper of the 9th of April this year, this month, a report on a study of future possible commitments by the British Ministry of Defence. Now, I know how these things are carried out, and it's going on all the time in the staff corridors, looking at this sort of possibility. But what is very significant to me, one future commitment, I quote again, the middle classes could become a revolutionary class, taking the role envisaged for the proletariat by Marx, says the report. The thesis is based on a growing gap between the middle classes and the super-rich on one hand, and an urban underclass threatening social order. Now, for a formal Ministry of Defence study to pick up this one as a future military commitment, a possible future commitment, is pretty staggering stuff. Because what they're really talking about is an uprising of the middle class of a magnitude which could have the most profound implications, a bloody revolution. Now, the population in this country is far too passive, has always been far too passive to provoke an armed struggle. I mean, there have been the odd insurrections. Go back to Wat Tyler and the Peasants' Revolt in, I think it was the 14th century. But they're jolly few and far between. So for this to be a serious commitment means that the signs are there. And, of course, one goes back to this New Zealand report, Communist Councils in New Zealand, which was mentioned last time. And this, giving a thorough background of the financial markets and the economic pattern and the privatization of public services in this country repeatedly, in effect, to produce capital which only services is irredeemable debt on a grand scale. This, of course, is the attack on the middle class, which I think is why it's important to look at this further. Perhaps I could come back and have a look at what the middle classes actually are, because it may, I'm sure the interpretations vary, and this country, I think, has a particular composition, if you like, which has changed. In the time of Marx, in the 19th century, the middle classes were really the bourgeoisie, and they own the land, and they control the means of production and the money. And you had the proletariat, who, of course, were regarded as oppressed, and in fact were, of course, they were exploited for the most part, in Industrial Revolution conditions. But this, of course, has changed. But the conspiracy element is running right the way through this. If we can come back to the middle classes, as I say, I've been looking at Nesta Webster. Now, she wrote, and she was well-researched and well-respected, she wrote World Revolution in 1921.
In fact, we carry that book here.
Yeah. Now, this is well worth reading carefully. World Revolution, The Plot Against Civilization. That subtitle is just as important, in my view. And the she quotes the French Revolution, which is the start point, which carried on through the 19th century, as involving the objective, with the Illuminati inspiring this thought, of an international brotherhood. Now, here we have the seed corn of international socialism, the internationalism of Karl Marx. And in many ways, it's been argued, of course, that Karl Marx is merely a continuum of the French Revolution philosophy and not totally original. Now, Nesta Webster was credible enough in 1920 to be invited to address the officers of the Royal Regiment of Artillery in Woolwich, southeast London, which is their traditional base. Now, in the same year, a few months later, she was invited to London to address the Brigade of Guards and the Metropolitan Police on the World Revolution. Now, this is significant because it does mean that in that day, at that time, in the 1920s, World Revolution was taken seriously, and so were the factors involved.
Well, you know, I think that the thing about this whole World Revolution is that what there many of the liberals, many of the revolutionaries, many of the communists and socialists have never realized is that this was the plan of the people of great wealth. You talked about that quotation from Walter Rathenau back in 1909. That actually can be found on page 61 of Professor Quigley's book, which we carry, and Professor Quigley was Bill Clinton's mentor, certainly one of the outstanding historians of the last century. And what, if you read this very, very carefully, you'll find out that this whole world revolutionary movement that employs those people of revolutionaries on the far left are being manipulated by these people of great wealth who want this world revolution because eventually it will result in what they really want, and that is a one world government, a one world religion, and a one world leader who they will control or work for or be associated with. And that is what the far left doesn't understand. This whole world revolution has been guided by people of great wealth, the very people that they think they're opposing.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think the, of course, Tragedy and Hope, Quigley's Tragedy and Hope with his 1,348 pages, is a massive read. It's one that I take off the shelves and read the relevant pages or sections when I need them. But of course, I couldn't agree more. It's a key book which anybody concerned should have on their bookshelves. And it does give that evolution of economic power, financial power, during the 1920s, the first three decades of the last century.
And, of course, I think it's so important that there really is just a very, very small group. Back in 1909, they call them the Committee of 300, or call it what you will. Today we call it the Bilderbergers of the Trilateral Commission. Just a small group of people who select their successors who control the wealth of the world. And now, in my opinion, and I think Colonel Turner would agree, are now moving towards the destruction of the middle class, the destruction of the value of our currency, the destruction of our sovereignty, and of course the enslavement of our people. Go right ahead, Colonel. Pick up the story there.
You're, Yes, your mention of these factors is interesting because the Royal Institute of International Affairs, of course, a parallel organization to your Council on Foreign Relations, was set up, of course, by Lord Milner and his confederates. And it is supposedly an impartial, independent study group. And a lot of people clearly are members because they genuinely believe in looking at world affairs through the RIIA, known popularly as Chatham House. But you see, one of the people associated with this was the Fabian socialist Professor Arnold Toynbee. Now, he was director of studies for about 15 or 20 years. And in 1931, he gave us an address in Copenhagen in which, and I haven't got it handy, it's too long to quote, and I think I mentioned it last time, the objective was to remove the sovereign independence of, I think he quoted, 52 nation states that populate the civilized world, that cover the civilized world, the Western world. And he makes it quite clear that this is going to be done by stealth, in the sense that people won't notice it's happening. Well, of course, it happened in many stages along the way. And here you have another strand to this situation. I mean, if we go back again to the time of Karl Marx, the Communist Manifesto to destroy private property and inheritance, apart from the attack on the family and religion and tradition. Now, there you have the factors involved in destroying the bourgeoisie. And the modern bourgeoisie, broadly speaking, the middle classes, have remained the target. But, of course, the circumstances have changed in a century and a half. That's inevitable. So the target, the whole scenario, has, as it were, reshaped, rejigged itself to the current requirement, the current challenge. Now, the Fabians, of course, also came into being in the latter part of the 19th century. Now, they, of course, believe in socialism by the slow road. And socialism and Fabianism, you might as well regard as one. And we're talking about international socialism, of course, because following the early philosophy of the French Revolution, we have the attack on the state. It's implicit in all this internationalism that the nation state is to disappear, to create this ideologically impossible international brotherhood. Now, in The Socialist Network by Nestor Webster, a rather smaller book but equally fascinating and detailed, published in 1926, she mentions the Second and a Half International. In fact, it shows in a chart included and pocketed at the back of the first edition, the early edition of this book, and it's a hugely complicated chart. It shows the entire network of the socialist, communist, Marxist organizations and their interrelationships. And there is the Second and a Half International. Now, this is the point in a series of 1, 2, and 3.
Hold that now right there, please. And, of course, I guess it's Colonel Barry Turner, and we're talking about this plan of socialism to bring about a one-world government. But what most socialists do not understand is that, you know, what they're really doing is strengthening the hand of the very people they oppose. I mean, they supposedly are organized to combat and counter the wicked capitalists who are taking advantage of them. What they do not understand is that, yeah, back at the beginning of the 20th century, a small group of socialists met together with the world's leading bankers in a group known as the Coefficients, and you'll find this described in H.G. Wells' book, An Experiment in Autobiography, well worthwhile reading, which of course led to several books. One was The New World Order, the other was a book called The Open Conspiracy, where Wells talked about how they would work with the bankers to bring about the world government. What was their goal? where the goal was to use foolish idealists to bring about a world revolution and destroy all the governments in the world and then bring them under centralized control, because the goal has always been to do away with the existing social order and replace it with a new one where you would have, of course, everything controlled by the state. And certainly you would have a ruling oligarchy and then the enslavement of the average individual. And people say this could never happen, and yet it's happening in America as we accept centralized planning. It's happening in Europe as they accept centralized planning. We're losing our sovereignty here in the United States as we are merging with Canada and Mexico, just as England has lost their sovereignty as they merge with the European Parliament. And the average individual sees what's going on, knows something is wrong, but can't figure it out because it doesn't make sense. Why would the socialists be working with the capitalists? Aren't they enemies? And the truth of the matter is that is just for public consumption. The truth of the matter is the leaders of the world socialist and the world communist movement are working with the people of great wealth, because, of course, there is a spiritual component, in my estimation, behind this entire movement. But, Colonel, you go ahead and pick up this story.
Well, just as a quick digression, this question of collaboration, of course, is recorded now, who was the man who wrote Military Aid to the Soviet Union?
That was, of course, Professor Anthony Sutton.
Anthony Sutton, yes. Now, his series of books exposed the collaboration during the so-called Cold War, when the popular image was of a total divide between East and West. But you see, British governments were signing agreements on collaboration, which nobody was told about. You could get them in command papers, government command papers, the official record, which you could publish from the stationery office. But, of course, how many people knew about this, and therefore how many people obtained this information? Jolly few. But our ministers of both major parties, Conservative and Labour, were signing these agreements. And it was, if you read them carefully, it was open collaboration. Now, what on earth were we playing at? And, of course, Dr. Sutton wrote about the open collaboration in a commercial way, providing vehicle manufacturing plants and all manner of things, providing, state-of-the-art computers to the Soviet Union. And, of course, we know this story of, I think it was the ships carrying military stores to North Vietnam were Western-made ships or something. I may have got it wrong, but that is the sort of theme.
Well, of course, it was really the almost all of the Soviet military aid that was given to the North Vietnamese was manufactured in Russia, which was receiving large aids and technical transfer and financial help from our government and the European governments. Certainly, we were financing the Soviets, who were financing the North Vietnamese, who were killing American boys in South Vietnam, exactly as today. We're financing Pakistan, that is financing Pakistani intelligence, that's financing the Afghans, who are killing American boys. I should say the Taliban are killing American boys in Afghanistan, so nothing has really changed. And we're still actually funding tremendous amounts of money into the Soviet Union today under the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, in the name of fighting AIDS, in the name of just giving humanitarian aid to those good old Russians. And people find this so difficult to believe. We're giving that Russia and the Eastern European satellites several billion dollars every single year right now in the name of AIDS. Why are we doing that? Most of those countries are totalitarian dictatorships. The average American has no idea what's really going on. So you pick up the story there. Well, I guess we've got to take a break here, and then we'll get back to Colonel Turner. But so much of what goes on, the American people don't know. If you'd like, of course, to read more, you'll want to get certainly my March newsletter. It to be sent out very soon, or within about 2 weeks, it'll be available on our website at radioliberty.com. Well, Colonel, you turn, you go right ahead and pick up the story there.
If I go back to one of the milestones along the way, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which I just mentioned, I have in my paper, in my hand, World Order Papers. This is paper number one by Sir John Fisher Williams. Now, World Order strikes a pretty chill note. The interesting point here is that this first one was published in 1939. Now, this is before we'd gone through the Second World War, of course, and before it was possible to draw any public conclusions, as it were, on the future course of the world. And yet here was the Royal Institute sponsoring these four papers. In one sense, it's logical to look at the future in a research sense and identify the way the world may shape up. But there's something ominous about this too, because the one world, of course, smacks of one world controls. And it's a curious point that these papers should have been sponsored then. This is the what I see, it is purely my point of view, as the sinister core of the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And I had one good friend. He's well into his 90s now. But he was a great campaigner. He founded, with his wife, Medical Aid for Palestinians after the Sabra Shatila massacres and the West Beirut episode. And he said to me one day, quite casually, he said, well, yeah, I'm a member of the Royal Institute. He said, I found it a rather interesting sort of organization, you know, rather useful to be a member of. And, of course, they've got a huge library, which is handy for general reference. And they do produce some interesting publications. But it's the core, what is going on at the heart of this organization. I think they've got about five, six directors of different elements of sort of world affairs, are specialized in different areas. Dr. Henry Kissinger is a member, and he and others of his ilk have spoken. They've addressed meetings at the Royal Institute. So you have this interesting grey area between a sensible idea and an organization which is working towards the world order. It's one of the organizations, like the CFR, I suppose. But if we look
Hold that thought right there. We're going to have to bring our other station back on board. Well, our guest is Colonel Barry Turner. Colonel, before we go on, do you have a website or any information you'd like to get out to our listeners before we go on?
I'm afraid I don't. No. I abandoned the net early last year.
All right, fine. Well, let me just mention, there is an interlock between these organizations. Basically, the Royal Institute of International Affairs is part of a network of organizations found in the Commonwealth nations, and every major Commonwealth nation, whether it be South Africa or Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and even many of those in Africa, has a Royal Institute of International Affairs in their country. Now, that is the British counterpart of the Council on Foreign Relations. The whole movement was put together in 1919 at a meeting in Versailles, which was attended, of course, by Lord Milner and Lord Grey and the members of what was known as the Roundtable Organization at that time, people like Leo A. Marie and Lionel Curtis. Names that wouldn't mean much to our listeners unless they've studied the history of that time. The men who, of course, made a profound impact on the peace settlement and the Versailles Treaty, specifically designing a treaty that was destined to fail because they needed a Second World War. And just as today they need a Third World War, and they're planning it, so they needed a Second World War because it was very obvious the League of Nations was not going to become a reality. That was to have been the world government following the First World War. In fact, that's what the First World War was all about. It was all about a war to make the world safe for democracy. the war to end all wars. And that was the slogan. Oh, they have these wonderful slogans, the war to end all wars. And our boys went over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die, honestly thinking it was the war to end all wars, without realizing it was all contrived to bring about a world government. But the English counterparts, and certainly the Americans, then decided that they would begin working behind the scenes secretly. And they created the Royal Institute, the headquarters at Chatham House and St. James Wood over there in London, not too far from Trafalgar Square, and in New York City at 5868 Street, the so-called Harold Pratt House. And these two groups worked together with the counterparts throughout the world and probably at least 100 different front organizations towards this one goal, a new world order, a new world religion, a new world leader. So please pick up the story there.
Let me go back to this Fabian question quickly. The Fabian socialism parted ways with the communist fast track, if you like, revolutionary struggle through this Second and a Half International that was is in the chart in Nestor Webster's book. The we know the armed struggle failed in Europe. It just wouldn't take root. As I've already said, the British are pretty passive for one. It certainly didn't take place only briefly in Germany. So the communist revolution, the bloody revolution, failed. But the ideological struggle, which of course is the counterpart of the armed struggle, began in earnest. And this is what has worked its way through our society into political correctness and so on and so forth. The oppressive bureaucracies, the mentality which has been bred through the universities and is now in the bloodstream in high places. And not many people, I find, have ever heard of the Institute for Social Research, which was founded in Frankfurt in 1923, known as the Frankfurt School. Four people were prominent there: Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno, Herbert Marcuse, and Eric Fromm. And of course, they worked on the academic approach to breaking down society, again repeating Marx, but not in a bloody revolutionary sense, by attacking the family, attacking tradition, attacking morality, attacking the culture. And of course they've been highly successful. This is Gramsci's march through the institutions. Gramsci, the Italian communist who spent most of his life under lock and key. And an interesting one here, in this undercurrent of revolution which was undermining Western society, in 1926, Madame Chiang Kai-shek in China had discussions with Mikhail Borodin. He was a Soviet agent in China. His real name was Grützenberg, and his wife, apparently, was a relative of Buster Keaton. Now, I got the book. It's quite interesting. It's not a very big book. It's in half in Chinese, not surprisingly, and half in English. But he made the point that the liberal establishment, the liberal intellectuals, would be a major weapon in this revolution. In other words, the liberal ideology, the if you like, the wishful thinkers, and sometimes the do-gooders have had a huge impact here. They loosen the strands of discipline. Well, in a disciplined society, you have to say, well, where does the balance of discipline lie? But the liberal tendency has clearly been to destabilize the discipline far too far. And, of course, this is where, I can't remember whether it was Theodor Adorno or Herbert Marcuse, were behind the student insurrections of the 1960s. And this is, of course, is the challenge to authority. Now, along with this, you had in this country, the anti-elitism and the egalitarianism in education, which did enormous damage, because in the senior levels of our secondary schools is where we had what we call the prefect system. You may have the same over there, where the senior boys in the sixth form learn how to run things, learn how to become leaders and managers. And when they cut that out as being elitist, and had a one-size-fits-all approach, then, of course, it undermined the sort of people we're now putting into senior positions. A classic case, in my view, are chief constables of our police forces around the country. And you, instead of decent leaders, proper leaders in a proper, balanced way, you have sociologists, people with sociology degrees, who are imbued with the politically correct principles. Now, of course, this destabilizes that sort of organization. It is now in the national bloodstream, I fear. But it was an interesting point made to Madam Chiang Kai-shek in China that was so relevant to what is happening here today. The other point which occurs to me as I talk is that we have in the what is, in effect, the international socialist government of Tony Blair, whatever the original Labour concept, as between the Labour Party and Conservative Party, one representing the workers and the other representing the owners of production and the land. Now, that was fine when we had national borders, and it was largely confined to the national borders. And you're going back to the 19th century. Today, the whole thing has changed. But overall, we have what, in effect, is a government in this country which is nothing different in principle to the nomenklatura of the Soviet Union. Privileged, corrupt, and controlling the reins of power with precious little democracy. Of course, it is written in as democratic, but in fact, in practice, once parliament in this country has been elected, there's a rubber wall between the serious concerns of the electorate, if you take the Iraq war as an example, and politicians are keeping these present batch of ministers, Tony Blair and the rest of his crew, in power. They could vote them out, but it's in their own selfish interests, within the, if you like, the confines of Westminster, to keep them in power. Because if this government was voted out, as they ought to be, on moral grounds, on logical grounds, then, of course, a large number of the 650, certainly Labour MPs, members of Parliament, would lose their seats. They would be slaughtered if there was a general election. So it suits them to keep this government in power. It's guilty of war crimes, as we know, in the Middle East, purely by sanctions against Iraq, which were illegal anyway over 10 years from the first Gulf War, and the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, which was jigged, if you like, by the Lord Chancellor's advice. I think it was the UN Resolution 141, where he offered a very dodgy interpretation, which let Blair move through the net.
And of course, they had the Downing Street memos there. And of course, I think that you have the same problem in Great Britain that we have here. You have two political parties really both going the same direction, but you have to give the people the impression that there is a difference between them. But both political parties, at least the leadership, is dedicated to this idea of this world government. And this is the same thing here in America. I mean, we see them getting up and they speak and they have all these so-called lengthy debates and they pound the lectern and, oh, we're going to get our troops out of Iraq, but they have no intention of getting our troops out of Iraq. And, of course, they put on an amendment to the funding bill for a billion and a quarter, upping $125 billion for funding, that says the president can't, invade Iran, and then they take that off, which gives him tacit, permission to go ahead and invade Iran. All the time they're talking against it. So it's all talk. It's simply symbolism over substance, rhetoric over reality. It's entertainment. But, of course, the tragedy is an awful lot of people are dying on the world stage today. And an awful lot of men's lives are being destroyed, and an awful lot of Iraqis are going to die, and British troops, and the public, is so confused, they can't figure out what's going on. We thought in America that when we got rid of the Republicans, we got the Democrats in, something had changed. but they have no intention of changing it. They change the names of the leadership, but the same policies continue. Now, that's exactly what Professor Quigley talked about in his amazing book, Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time, on pages 1247 and 48. He said, you got to have elections every 4 years so that the public can throw the rascals out. But, of course, it won't make any difference because the same foreign and domestic policies will continue. And I'm sure that's the same thing in your country, isn't it, as well, Colonel?
Oh, yes. I last autumn, I hope I'm not repeating what I said in the last broadcast, but last autumn, I met a senior retired army officer. We were having a drink, and he still has very close ties with Westminster. And what he said to me, after we discussed a lot of the things we've been talking about in the last half hour or so, he said, quite frankly, he said, between the two major political parties, there is no difference. He said, you couldn't get a cigarette paper between them. And I think this is very true. He said, they have one objective, and that is power. But if you look at what is happening here, what is happening in America, the Guardian newspaper yesterday published quite a long article by an American, Naomi Wolf, and the heading was Fascist America in 10 Easy Steps. Now, it's taking place here through directly, on my experience and observation, political correctness to a large extent, and oppressive legislation. But here, of course, it states that America is taking steps to constrain protest, to constrain the press, to constrain education, to harass citizens' groups, set up internal surveillance, to develop a thug caste. Now, that's an interesting one, using contractors, not just as they do in the Middle East, but as part of the security organization. And they mention it after the use of the contractors after Hurricane Katrina. And these people seem to be pretty well absolved from any responsibility, any censure. So this is what is happening in according to this article by an American, in the United States, targeting key individuals, arbitrary detention. And the theme of the article, apart from identifying these 10 areas, is to point out that, you know, the land of the free is no such thing. I have no doubt people can live out their lives there quite peaceably without interfering in anything and without getting into trouble. But the moment you stick your head above the parapet, and it's a ghastly thought, because the comparison is with dictatorships, such as, well, it refers to the coup in Thailand recently and the steps taken by the leaders to suppress opposition. But it also refers to fascist Italy before the war and Nazi Germany. And the article, in effect, is saying, what's the difference? And, of course, 9/11 triggered that off. And from what I've read, there is still a great deal of doubt about what happened on the 9/11 and what was really behind it. But this is the situation we're faced with. But have I got time to just mention this middle-class thing?
Go right ahead, and I'll have to interrupt when we have to, but go right ahead.
Okay. No, it's one that interests me, because taking the process forward from the 19th century, for a long time, certainly in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s, we had the division between what we call the white-collar workers and the blue-collar workers. And the men in industry who worked in blue overalls, the technicians, the tradesmen, many of them very highly skilled. If you worked in administration or management or an office, however junior, the most junior clerk, you know, one thought in terms of the white collar. Now, this resentment on the part of organized labor built up through the 1930s, when the administrative part of the middle class, the ordinary urban middle class, became, as it were, class conscious. They had different standards. They developed a sort of artificial barriers and so on and so forth. Now, that was fine. Now, there's been a huge redistribution of wealth in the last 50 years, and we've lost industry, so we've lost a lot of this skilled labor in the sort of the working class, as it was designated. And prosperity has spread down into that area to leave, you know, the more menial element of society, as it were, the street cleaners, the refuse collectors and the like, stirring people that there may be, but it has left the poorer class on that margin. But above the middle class, this wide spectrum, you have enormous wealth. And there's a big grey area between the middle classes and the upper classes, if you can define them. And they're very conveniently used as terms. Now, the more wealthy you get, and the more divorced from the urban scenario you get, the more you're able to go into private education, private health, and this is where the real wealth begins. It's in land ownership, it's in the bigger businesses, it is in the legal profession as a growth industry. I think it's the same on your side of the Atlantic. And they can opt out financially. Now, they're in, as they merge into the upper classes and the aristocracy,
hold where
you have land owners.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back, please. Well, Kerner, we've got about 3 minutes to wrap things up, so you go right ahead.
Well, the middle class is the target, and the middle class is the urban middle class that can't escape the managerial, executive, professional, academic classes. And it's constantly used as a term. In education, the middle classes are attacked for seeking privileges compared with the ordinary people, whoever they may be. And it's going on constantly to undermine this middle class. In other words, it's the intelligent, on the ground, town, city, country element of thinking man, the professional people and so on and so forth, who present a threat, a potential threat, to what is going on. Once they start thinking, then the one-worlders have got big trouble. The wealthy, the super-rich, who are grossly bloated, City of London, the celebrity culture, the media, entertainment, so on and so forth, hugely overpaid. But once the split begins, and once the middle classes begin to object to being constantly exploited and overtaxed to carry the rest who are living off their backs, this much wider middle class, then we're going to have trouble. And we're back to this Minister of Defence study about a revolt sometime in the future, and it does close the loop with this New Zealand report.
Well,
so
I really feel you're absolutely right. I think as the people face poverty, as we, of course, have more crime and uncertainty, as people see the great disparity between people of great wealth and, of course, Lee Raymond, recently retired as CEO of Exxon, and was given a nice little golden parachute, $400 million, of course, extracted from people by manipulating the price of oil here. And so people have to really understand that we're moving, though, away from the middle class. And, of course, the plan is, the ultimate plan, is the redistribution of wealth that's laid out in the Earth Charter, equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. They're going to lower the living standards of the British middle class. They're going to lower the standards of the American middle class, and we will go from where we have been in the past, which was really a very equitable society, into the society they have in Mexico, where they have a few billionaires, and then, of course, everybody else is impoverished, other than those who have a government job. Well, Colonel, we're out of time, and I thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you with us in the not-too-distant future.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope it's been worth it, and people have learned something in our discussion.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is Colonel Barry Turner, talking about really what's happening in England, but the same things are happening here. If you doubt that there is a master plan, that the Earth Charter is the new Ten Commandments for our society, that there are powerful spiritual forces at work, you can go up on the Internet, pull down the Earth Charter, or if you can't find it, we'll be glad to send you a copy. And, of course, this is written by Gorbachev. It's written by Marie Strong And, of course, it's written by Stephen Rockefeller, who is, of course, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, and the Rockefellers are the most wealthy family in America. And if you honestly believe it's Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, you've been reading Time magazine for far too long. There is a plan, and behind that there are powerful spiritual forces at work, and that's why, of course, you need to get my talks on the Brotherhood of Darkness and the Forbidden Secret and Chris Pinto's wonderful DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, and Riddles in Stone. Now, there is a move towards an authoritarian society. If you've not seen our 4-tape set on the Military Commissions Act, you need to get it. You need to get our material on concentration camps. Why are they simply refurbishing those old Japanese concentration camps to the tune of $38 million? Well, they will tell you it's because we don't want people ever to forget how terrible it was to put people in concentration camps. But if that's really true, why are they giving Halliburton $385 million to build new concentration camps? Now, if you doubt what I'm saying, you can go up on the Internet and Google in Japanese concentration camps, $38 million, and then Halliburton, $385 million detention camps. You'll find out what I'm telling you is true. You need to get our 4-tape set on concentration camps. You need to get our videos, America Behind Barbed Wire, and amazing clips. They're available separately, or as part of something we call the Concentration Camp Special. And then, of course, my talk. It's a talk we gave back in 2002, but it's really very apropos for today. It's called The Dangerous Deception. And, of course, what happened after 2002 and how they used desperate deception and how they used 911 to justify getting the legislation through. Isn't it interesting that it was only Democrat senators that got the anthrax-laden letters, and they've just never been able to figure out who did those letters. But we know, and we can have the documentation, that on the very night of 9-1-1, the vice president and the White House staff and the president started on Cipro, which is specific for anthrax. Oh, shucks, why did they suspect there was going to be an anthrax attack? And if they did, why didn't they tell us common folks? Well, of course, you need to understand what happened on 9-1-1. We have actually three little pamphlets, a summary of my articles, and it's called Foreknowledge 9-1-1. They're inexpensive, all three pamphlets for certainly only $9.95, I think they are. Or you can go up on the Internet and pull down my August, September, October, November, and December 2006 newsletters. Do that at no charge. Print them out, read them through several times, and, of course, you will know what really happened on 9-1-1. And that is August to December of 2006. RadioLiberty.com, get the facts. Get other people listening to our programs. Understand this is a spiritual battle, and there are powerful spiritual forces. And then, of course, that God is about to bring his judgment on America. My telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America and pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and pray for, certainly, revival. Because if the people of this country don't turn back to God, we're going to lose America. Then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And remember our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.